Okay, so it's time for a bit of a discussion, a dialogue with our four panellists. I think you'll agree that both Tash and Michael were fascinating. Tash from an ag tech update and some of the things that are going on there. Tash, I saw that one of your Connect groups has a member called Cows from Space. We might hear a bit more about that later. And Michael, thank you for some of the value-adding opportunities and the digital opportunities in the sector. So we've got a little bit of time together now to ask our panellists some questions. I think you all know the way this works. There are some people in the room. If you've got a question, please put your hand up and a mic will get to you. Try to make it a question rather than a statement, if you can. But I'll get the ball rolling. While I do that, have a think about who you'd like to ask a question to. I might start with Ross from AGIC. Ross, fascinating talk earlier, pre-lunch. Seems like an age ago, I know, for you. What external threats and opportunities do you think will most shape Western Australia as we look into the near term?
So let's start with the positives. So we examine what are the opportunities for West Australian agriculture. West Australian agriculture, by its nature, we have a small domestic population, we have a large ability to produce agricultural products, so our opportunity lies mostly offshore. So our principal agricultural industries are the grains sector. And what are the future opportunities for grains? Well, they are large and many. Fortunately, we have the world's fourth largest country in terms of population to our near north in Indonesia. We know that Indonesia towards 2050 is going to become probably the fifth most rich country in the globe. It's experiencing huge per capita increases in its income. So its population each year is growing by the magnitude of Western Australia's entire population. So it's like taking all of Western Australia and sprinkling it across the islands of Indonesia. That represents a massive annual increase in demand for the sorts of products that we produce. As people get richer, we know that they consume more dairy products, fruit, meat. They also switch away from rice into wheat-based products, and they consume more breads, cakes, pastries. So the opportunity for West Australia's grain sector is immense. As Michael was saying, as people get more healthy, they demand the sorts of grains that we are skilled at producing, which is our oats, our barley, for malt in particular. So on the opportunity side, there's rich pickings, I think, for Western Australia. Turning quickly to the threats, we're not the only producers of exportable surpluses of grain in the world. We know that from the Black Sea region, Ukraine, Russia, there's been massive increases in their grain production in the last five or so years. Similarly, Argentina has an ability to produce and export grain. So although the doors are there for us to walk through in Southeast Asia and China, the competition is also there. And that's a big threat for us. The other threat, I think, is that although the customer for our agriculture is an international customer, often the way in which our food is produced is going to be determined by the local consumer and voter. And I think that's a challenge for Western Australian agriculture. Although our future lies beyond our shores, the way in which we embrace those opportunities are increasingly being governed by the sentiments of our local population.
Great, thank you. Bruce, I might get you to add to that a little bit in terms of the opportunities. I'm thinking now about the demand for our premium products through Asia, for example, such as yours. What do you see as the opportunities and what are some of the challenges with creating that demand in the end markets from Pardew's perspective?
Well, one of the obvious advantages that we have is we have a very pristine environment. So I think in the past we have not been collectively trying to promote our advantages. So for instance, we see that For instance, if we try to promote WA beef or a regional beef as a branding, I think that would potentially create value out of that, like the bottled wine. How about the Pilbara beef, all right, as a category? It may not happen overnight, but we need certain amount of promotion and thinking outside of the box to create that. I think the other thing that I see as a mass advantage of WA have for the meat industry, in for instance, is with some of the feed available, there are two buzzwords in North Asia now, is actually hormone and hormone-free and non-GMO. And both of that, I think WA can do very well. We just haven't been trying to promote ourselves as that, and we haven't stand out to do that. So I think if we focus as a group, industrial group, as a part of the government initiative to promote that, I think we can create a lot of value out of it.
Listening to you speak today, it sounds like you've had to do a lot of that off your own bat. How much is going on at a collective level in your industry or in others?
It comes and goes. So I have to draw back to an experience that I did for WA. About 3 years ago, I went to Shenzhen, and I rounded up about 300 food professionals, and I get some of our WA producers to send up produce for Don Hensley, which is our food ambassador, to cook up. Little did I realize what type of task that was, because I soon find out all these exotic productions of produce that we have doesn't have a category to import. And consequently, it's almost like I'm the master smuggler and trying to smuggle seafood, live animals all over, and this is so chaotic. But they all love to come. But then we realize that isn't there. And I think that should be either an industry or a government initiative to help the smaller producers to get to that. Otherwise, they would all be stuck at a domestic level and never able to scale up. And unless they are able to scale up, the importers over on the other end are not willing to deal with it.
Okay, great. Any questions at this stage? All right, keep thinking about some questions, guys. We've got one just over here.
Terry Lee, financial advisory firm in Applecross. A question to Bruce. I'm also, there's no DNA in me in farming, so I'm same as you. I'm very curious about after being here for over 40 years, the resentment hasn't changed as to foreign ownership of farms. I mean, this is getting a bit ridiculous now, judging from the risks you're taking and all the resources you have plowed in, 5 hours with a 91-year-old man trying to convince him. And yet the mainstream, I'm quite surprised, you know, that somehow or rather, the buyers from Europe or America or Americans, they are all right if they are buying farms, including white farmers from South Africa with the apartheid background. That is all right, but with an Asian buying farm, it's not, it's not tolerable. And somehow or rather, how do you change the mindset, judging from the achievement they are making, you know, 750 jobs and all that. And some of them are so resentful that they will drop by my office and say, hey, we are selling, excuse the pun, selling our farm, to all these bloody foreigners as usual. So the surprisingly, sorry Shane, even from Canberra, you don't get any help. They have the same mindset. So what's wrong, is globalizing now the whole world. And somehow or other, the average person in the street still can't stomach Asians buying up farms, you know. So what's going on?
Well, that's a difficult one. Maybe we talk about it over a drink. frankly, that obviously bothered me because we want to scale up, and we want to compete fairly in the marketplace. And of course, if I go and make an offer on a farm currently, and I'm over the limit, and I have to go through FERP, that is another uncertainty that the seller have to face. But having said that, I think I don't look at myself as a foreigner, because the initiative I'm doing here is a regional initiative for Pilbara. So if a project like mine and a push like mine is not supported, which is supported, then I think, obviously, then I have something to pitch. I believe that if we put our heart and mind and have a very long-term view of investing, then I think that mindset inevitably would change. And initially, up in Pilbara, I get a lot of naysayers. I must say, I have a lot of negative feedbacks. But people eventually see that you're real, you're sincere, you actually do what you say, and they become your friends. And the same with the indigenous communities also. I get a very unusual question once by my elder, and he asked me, all these owners come and go, when are you leaving me? And I gave him a very roundabout answer. And I told him, really, Jeffrey, you see me putting all these pivots, tens of million dollars on the ground. So you know that it's not something for me to answer, but for my son and my grandson to answer you. After they have recovered or recouped my investment. So he liked the answer, and he became one of my best friends.
Michael, from a CSIRO perspective, what's the research community thinking in terms of some of the opportunities to continue to grow agriculture in this state?
One I'd like to call out is the aquaculture sector. I think there's a huge opportunity here. It's the fastest growing sector percentage-wise in Australia at the moment. It passed beef 2 years ago on a world stage as the as a source of animal protein. So it's the salmon industry is going gangbusters in Tasmania. We've got prawn farms developing along the coast in Queensland and through the territory. We've seen Mindaroo decide to invest in a major investment along the Ningaloo coast. So I think there's huge opportunities here. It's an industry with a lot of value-adding opportunities. It's got vertical integration opportunities, as I described with the canola example before. So I wanted to point out that one, and it's an industry that needs lots of good science and technology. A lot of these species that are being grown need genetic improvement, aren't long ago domesticated species, actually. And there's also whole lots of opportunities there around managing impacts on the environment, on the marine environment particularly. So I think that's a really exciting area, Todd. I also just call out another area, which is I think helping our ruminant livestock industries grapple with these, I think, dilemmas it's facing at the moment around the increasing demand that Ross pointed out in the face of rising costs, particularly labour costs. this pressure on animal welfare concerns, both on farm and to do with live exports, and also this pressure, which will eventually hit livestock producers, around the need to show that they're mitigating the methane emissions that livestock are producing from their farms. There's a lot R&D can do to help with all of these issues, whether it be technologies, digital technologies to sense and monitor and help farmers manage their livestock, whether it be food additives that can help deal with the methane issue in the guts of these animals, whether it be other tools to help manage the welfare state of them as they're leaving the country on ships. So there's some huge R&D opportunities there, I think, to help WA. And for those of you who don't realise that, our sheep flock in the West has been slowly falling. I'm not sure how long now, Ross, something like 30 or 40 years. And we've got to somehow turn that around if we want particularly sheep to stay in the state and be an integral part of our farming system, because our cropping farmers need them, both for diversification, for risk management, and for controlling weeds on their farms.
Okay. I think we have a question from the floor.
My name's Steve Mason. I'm with a group called Innovation Central Midlands out of the Wheat Belt, and I'm tied up with a project called WA SuperNet, which is attempting to facilitate the delivery of enterprise-grade broadband to agribusinesses and farmers. My question to you all, it's fantastic to see what's coming with ag tech and all the innovation, but from our understanding and our research, the digital connectivity is the thing that's holding back a lot of things, especially big data crunching, and where this can go in the future. So I'm really keen to hear what you all think about it. I'm not suggesting you've got an answer. Hopefully we have. But I'm keen to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Tash, you happy to comment on that in the context of ag tech?
Yep. Yeah, sure. And I hope you do have the answer, and I look forward to hearing it. So look, this raises a really important issue. And for farmers like my brother, he gets really frustrated when, you know, halfway across the paddock, you know, the internet breaks down and he can't, you know, doesn't work with all his yield mapping if you don't have consistent and reliable connectivity. It's very frustrating, not just for internet, but even phone connectivity from a safety point of view and a health point of view, if you don't have, you know, mobile phone access in regional WA. So it is, you know, important beyond just agriculture, I think. I know the government has invested quite heavily in a lot of digital connectivity grants, so I'm hoping they're going to make a difference. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to be up to probably the individual farmers to decide that they're going to go and invest in this as well. So I think it's hopefully the government grants are going to make a difference, and they are investing heavily. But individual farmers probably come to organisations like yours to help them just do it themselves.
They're pretty good at fixing things themselves, aren't they? Tash, I might stick with you. In terms of ag tech and some of the trends, you talked a bit about that in your presentation. What are some of the ag tech trends that you see coming that might move the needle, whether it's the 1%ers or something more in terms of reshaping agriculture?
Oh, yeah, good question. Look, there's lots of different things coming, and I did touch on a few of those. And I think, you know, linking back to what Ross was saying with those 1%ers, that's why there is so many good opportunities to invest in ag tech, because whether it's somewhere on the supply chain or, you know, value adding in some way or improving the cost for farmers, lots of opportunities. And I think, as I mentioned, blockchain is probably one of the ones that I think will make a big difference around food security and provenance tracking, all that, which everyone's, you know, Michael touched on this as well. People really care where the food is coming from these days. So that's, you know, a potential for a lot of export opportunities for some of the companies. The other area which I think will continue to, hopefully someone, as I said, will crack it, but around the precision ag and variable rate fertiliser and herbicide applications, things like, you know, the weed seeker technologies and even the swarm farm robotics that I already talked about, those areas where hopefully growers can use less inputs, so reducing fertiliser and herbicide runoff, it's going to have, you know, obviously save them money, but really important for the environment as well.
Okay, great, thank you. I think we have a question towards the back.
My name is Diane, and I'm coming from Indigenous Business Australia. I do have a question for probably all panel members, and that is, how do you, if you do, engage with Indigenous people. We've got quite a few clients that have cattle stations in Pilbara, in Kimberley. We also have clients that have other farming, cropping as well down south, and very often food preparation and game meat. So each one of you, I would like to hear if you engage and how do you engage if you do. Thank you.
Yeah, Bruce, I might get you to start if you don't mind.
All right. I think about close to 3 years ago, we started engaging outside of just our station. And we work with Mowanjum, cattle station up north, partly because they also have pivot development. And so it was one day when I was up in Darwin, and Mr. Davis at the time, the late Davis, he asked me to meet up with Steve Austin, who runs Mowanjum. At the time, the state had funded Mowanjum to build the pivots, but there were no cattle on there. So there is a perfect facility with no business model. The banks were not willing to lend. So at the time, Steve asked me, can you loan me 1,000 animals? So I was just in Australia, not long from there, but a lot of people say, advisors say, can't do that. You can't loan 1,000 animals to an Aboriginal station and expect an outcome. I looked at Steve and I said, Steve, I understand that, but if you don't mind me sending a person to look after my animals and we work out an adjustment relationship, I think that would be all right. He was shocked. 3 weeks from now, 800 animals arrive at his station. I took a 20% discount. And I sent the animals there, and we have been the best working relationship since. So he has been very happy. We are very happy with the outcome. And it has been a fantastic working relationship. And we are open, of course, to work with other Aboriginal stations up north.
Great, thank you. Ross, Tash, Michael, anyone want to comment on things they have seen?
Well, I could say just a quick word. I mean, CSIRO has a program of bringing Indigenous people into the organisation as cadets and trainees and trying to train them up and then help find employment for them. We see that as an important part of our mission. In terms of our research, we actually work quite actively with a number of communities across the north, particularly in terms of managing country and working how our Indigenous knowledge meshes with scientific knowledge and helping to groups to manage their country better and also take advantage of some of the business opportunities as well, like carbon credits, for example, around burning country, for example, in such a way that they can lose less carbon in smoke during a fire and therefore claim credits with the carbon trading scheme.
Okay, any other questions? Okay.
Andy Crane. Bruce, fantastic presentation, thank you very much, and great to see the aspiration for growth there. I think it was 6,000 hectares in 2030, is that right? Something like that you aspire to. A question for you and for Ross is, if you're giving any advice to the government on how they could help that become 60,000 hectares in the same time frame. I mean, ultimately, if this works, it needs to work at a scale that would support supply chains out of that area. So, Ross and Bruce, what else? What's needed to times that by 10?
I think there is enough water there, especially through the Broome Aquifer. And I believe solar technology is developing so rapidly that it could actually work. So normally, without the artesian water, the pumping and the depreciation cost per pivot of a 40 hectare would work out to be about 120,000. So that would be the 120,000 saving that I'm looking for from drilling a deeper artesian well. But the more shallow aquifer, there is quite a bit of water there. And I would believe that if the government is quicker in that process and be more supportive in the clearing process, that it would allow the pastoral station owner be more willing to invest and increase the production out of there.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Obviously, governments do have a role, I think, in facilitating economic development. I think history tells me that governments are often more risk-averse than they should be, and tend to be fairly constrained in what they do. I think if economic development is your goal and you're prepared to adhere to that and support that, then there's a number of things that government can do in both the provision of appropriate infrastructure, and we've mentioned that with respect to electronic infrastructure, physical infrastructure such as roads, rail. There's also educational infrastructure that's needed to ensure that you've got the sufficiently well-trained and competent staff that will support those businesses during their growth phase. And at the same time, there's that necessary role of government, which is that protective role of ensuring that while growth does occur, that it occurs in a way that's respectful of culture, that's respectful of country and environment, be that land-based or air-based or water-based environment. So there is that role, multifaceted role of government, and obviously the main criticism is that government does not move as quickly as it maybe should.
Can I add something more? I believe that land tenure pathway, the new possibilities of land tenure pathway also created a more willingness to invest. So I see a couple of stations are going down that pathway, and the easier we make that process, I think it would make the station owners a lot more willing to invest.
Okay, we're just about out of time, guys. I think we might call it there. I think you'll agree it's been fascinating today hearing from this diverse but yet unified in their aspirations for growth panel. Ross, Bruce, Tash, Michael, thanks so much for a great lunchtime session. Thank you.